Okay, so it's Sutta number 68, Nalakapana Sutta. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangkhang namassami. The Nalakapana Sutta, one of my favorite suttas. I quote this very often because it actually makes it very clear there's a point of Dhamma which is very important, especially to understanding how wisdom arises. But also the Buddha goes on afterwards and starts talking about why. He actually tells that some people are enlightened and some people aren't. And in other words, it actually inspires people as well as instructs them on some of the Dhamma. So here we go, Sutta 68, Nalakapana Sutta. And Nalaka, if I remember, Apana is like a market town. So it's a market town of Nalaka. Thus I have heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Kosalan country, at Nalakapana, in the Palasa Grove. And first of all, the Kosalan country was the one which was run by King Pasenadi of Magadha. His capital was at Sarvati. His whole area included where the Sakyans lived, not that far away from Sarvati. And it was roughly in like the north of the Ganges plain, butting up onto the Himalaya mountains, foothills anyway. Now, on that occasion, many very well-known clansmen had gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness under the Blessed One. When it says many well-known clansmen, these were people who were obviously of aristocrats, well-known families, wealthy parents, people who were, if you might say, famous in the society of the time. So well-known clansmen had gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness under the Blessed One. There was the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, who was the Buddha's cousin. Anuruddha was too. Kimbala, the Venerable Bhagu, the Venerable Kundadhana, the Venerable Rewata, the Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, and many other very well-known clansmen. Most of those were Sakyans. And especially of those three, Anuruddha, Nandiya and Kimbala, they were some of my favorite heroes in the time of the Buddha, because those three in particular were the ones who were living in perhaps the best monastery which we had a description of in the time of the Buddha. A monastery where they would hardly speak, they would only meet together maybe once every 4 or 5 days, and they would do all the duties very carefully, obviously without speaking, and they're spending all their days meditating. And that particular monastery these three were staying on once the Buddha came to visit, and they put a guard on the door of the little compound, and the guard said, "I'm sorry, Venerable, whoever you are, you can't come in here because we've got three monks meditating." And the guard, the doorman, didn't realize that who he was talking to was the Buddha. So fortunately, Anuruddha heard that voice, recognized it, and sort of went out very quickly and told the doorman, "Don't stop this person coming in. This is our teacher. This is the Buddha. Let him come in." But the Buddha was obviously very impressed that Nandiya, Kimbala, and Anuruddha were practicing very, very diligently. And of course, they all got enlightened with psychic powers. And on that occasion, the Blessed One was seated in the open, surrounded by the Sangha of bhikkhus. Then, referring to those clansmen, he addressed amongst us, "Bhikkhus, those clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness under me, do they delight in the holy life?" When this was said, those monks were silent. A second and a third time, referring to those clansmen, he addressed amongst us, "Monks, Those clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness under me, do they delight in the holy life? For a second and a third time, those monks were silent. Why do you think they were silent? No, they don't meditate when they're listening to the Buddha speak. No, I don't think it's not sure. It's almost like a humility. To delight in the holy life was almost like a euphemism. They were getting jhanas, they were getting enlightenment states. And the point being here is that even in those days, the monks would not say in public what they were doing with their attainments. Everyone would keep it very, very quiet. Maybe they would tell the teacher, but they wouldn't go announcing it in public. Yeah, I'm delighting because I get first jhana. I delight because I get fourth jhana. I delight because I get into the arupa states. I delight because I'm a stream winner. We didn't do that at all. So I've been saying recently that it's against the rules actually to announce that to lay people, but here it was just amongst the Sangha. And even then, the monks would not declare it publicly, they would just tell it to the Buddha. And the reason is, and now this comes up later on, that it's very clear when you read the Vinaya, the rules of conduct for a monk, that every monk, no matter just how old they are in reigns or how new they are, for example, in the nuns' monastery, and there's four nuns there now, and Sister Hasapanya has got now exactly the same vote. Same weight of vote as Sister Ajahn Wayama, even though she's just been ordained today. Same in my monastery. Because I've been there a long time, it doesn't mean that my vote is worth more than, say, Venerable Kassapa's. Because we have this wonderful idea of like a democracy of equity in the Sangha. And I think what the Buddha wanted was not to have, you know, like an aristocracy of monks, or what we usually call it these days, the aristocracy of monks. The Aryas are the noble ones. So we didn't really want, the Buddha never really wanted an aristocracy in the Sangha. All the monks were supposed to be looked upon as being even and equal. And that's why, not to tell of any attainments. So I really think that's why they were silent there, just to keep any attainments quiet. Do you delight in the holy life? Shh. Does that make sense? Because a lot of times it's a big ego trip to say that you're a saint or you can do this, you can do that. Then the Blessed One considered thus, paragraph 4. Suppose I question those clansmen. Then he addressed the Venerable Anuruddha thus. He was the leader of these. Anuruddha, do you all delight in the holy life? Now when it's actually asked directly by the Buddha, you've got no choice there. So he said, surely, Venerable Sir, we delight in the holy life. Good, good, Anuruddha. It is proper for all you clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into the homelessness to delight in the holy life. As you are still endowed with the blessing of youth, black-haired young men in the prime of life, just like myself and Sister Naroda, young and full of youth. No, we're not, unfortunately. As you are still endowed with the blessing of youth, black-haired young men in the prime of life, you could have indulged in sensual pleasures. Yet, you have gone forth from the home life into homelessness. It is not because you have been driven by kings that you have gone forth from the home life into homelessness, or because you have been driven by thieves, or owing to debt, or fear, or want of a livelihood. Rather, did you not go forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness after considering thus, I am a victim of birth, aging of death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. Yes, Venerable Sir. So there's a couple of points there to pause on. That first of all, the Buddha was actually asking whether the monks delighted you know, in being monks. And obviously Anuruddha said, yes, we all do delight in the holy life. That's a very powerful statement. Because sometimes people think that being a monk or being a nun is just so hard work. It's like a penance, like no pain, no gain idea. And in some, say, middle-aged Christian monastic traditions, they do used to do penance and whipping themselves and doing all sorts of weird practices. But here you can see the monks were delighting in the holy life. They were getting happiness and pleasure there. And the Buddha said, good, good, good. It should be a happy life. So if the monks were miserable, then they weren't following the Buddha's teachings. So the holy life is to be delighted in. And you can go and check that out. You go to Dhammasara, you go to Bodhinyana, and are the monks and the nuns delighting in being there? If they're practicing well, they will be. And also, people become monks and nuns, they're not driven by the government or by thieves or debt or want of a livelihood. As many of you know, that some of the monks are the sons of multimillionaires or even billionaires, and they still become monks. Or they're very successful in their life, but they still want to become monks or nuns. So it's not because they're doing this out of desperation. There's something more there. And what he's particularly saying is understanding the problem of existence. Each one of us is subject to death and sickness at any time. Some of you know Venerable Santuti's father died. They said he was only 56. Well, that's pretty old, I thought. But anyway, he died the other day, very suddenly. So everyone can die at any time. And it's also that we can be subject to other people's death and the soul which comes from that, grief, despair when things go wrong, or when your partner leaves you or you have to leave her or him. So there is so much suffering in the world, and they want to find a way out of that suffering. So that's why they went forth. Any questions before I go on? Okay, let's go. Oh, you got one. Ah, very good. And actually that translation has been an old translation which many, many people have, commented on. And they're not really happy with the translation for upayasa. It's just like another sort of form of suffering, but not really despair. What was the translation which, what's his name, who did the Middle Link sayings? Who was it? Been like saying, my mind has gone blank. Morris Walsh. Morris Walsh had a comment on that. Remember what was the translation he had for upayasa? I think it was. I think he even maybe used frustration, or something in that sort of way, but not so much despair. Just why is this happening to me? Anyway, having said why these people became monks and they should be delighting, we've already mentioned about sensory pleasure and that you're a young people but you still go forth as monks or nuns, and it says why and what you're supposed to do. So here we get the important paragraph which, for understanding the process to enlightenment, is very important, and one of the main reasons why I read this out today. What should be done, Anuruddha, by a clansman who has gone forth thus, while he still does not attain to the rapture and pleasure that are secluded from sensual pleasures and secluded from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that? Covetousness invades his mind and remains. Ill will invades his mind and remains. Sloth and torpor invade his mind and remain. Restlessness and remorse invade his mind and remain. Doubt invades his mind and remains. Discontent invades his mind and remains. Weariness invades his mind and remains. That is so, while he still does not attain to the rapture and pleasure that are secluded from sensual pleasures and secluded from unwholesome states. But, or to something more peaceful than that. But, when he does attain to the rapture and pleasure that are secluded from sensual pleasures and secluded from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that, covetousness does not invade his mind and remain. Ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, doubt, discontent, weariness, those seven things, do not invade his mind and remain. That is so when he attains to the rapture and pleasure that are secluded from sensual pleasures and secluded from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that. Now what that means, if anybody knows even a smattering of the Buddha's teachings, especially in Pali, what is the rapture and pleasure, the piti sukha, that are vivicca kamehi, vivicca akusalehi dhammehi? That is the rapture and pleasure that are secluded from sensual pleasures and secluded from unwholesome states. Who knows what that is referring to? Not just the jhanas, first jhana. The standard description of the first jhana is secluded from sensory pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. He dwells and abides in the piti sukha of the first jhana. So those people who know the texts know that that is 100% certainly describing the first jhana. Or to something more peaceful than that. And that's quite an obvious one. What's more peaceful than the first jhana? Second, third, fourth jhana, the arupa states. Or to something more peaceful than that. Now, these seven things, what do these remind you of? Covetousness, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, doubt, together with discontent and weariness. Yeah, the five hindrances with two others added. And there's something in there first of all. You've got the first one is covetousness, which is lokeya bija. And it's usually, maybe 60% of the time, the first hindrance is called karma chanda, which is, sometimes they call it desire, sensual desire. The covetousness is abhijja. And you may, these are those who know these suttas, you may have come across that word before in a very well-quoted sutta, where it says, having abandoned covetousness and grief for the world. That's in the Satipatthana Sutta, some of the prerequisites before you do Satipatthana meditation. And I often quote this, and you can check it out for yourself. If you read these suttas again and again and again, you'll find the first hindrance is sometimes called covetousness, sometimes called sensual desire. And because they're interchangeable, it's very clear that they are synonyms. Two words which have the same meaning. And it's very important to understand that in Satipatthana, because even the second word, when it says having abandoned covetousness, for the world should be covetous for the world and grief. The grief is called Domanassa, and in a couple of suttas that is in the place where we usually find ill will. It's a synonym for ill will. So even in the Satipatthana, you shouldn't start doing Satipatthana until you've overcome the first two hindrances, first of all. And the commentary says, and it's very clear that this is just the idioms of Pali, whenever you have a well-known group, such as the five hindrances, mentioning the first two is including all the other members of that group. So even the commentary say, before you do Satipatthana meditation, you have to abandon the five hindrances first of all. I'll pause there for a bit. That's coming soon. You're rushing ahead. But certainly what I've said so far, before you do the Satipatthana practice, you have to have abandoned the five hindrances.
Is that synonymous?
Now this comes in a few moments. Abandoning the five hindrances. Now that's an important part, because monks argue about this. But it's very, very clear. It's reasonable. And the next part, how do you abandon the five hindrances? This comes in the next part. It said, five hindrances plus these extra two, discontent and weariness, they invade the mind and remain as long as you don't get first jhana or something peaceful. People who do get first jhana or something more peaceful, only then do the five hindrances plus discontent and weariness not invade the mind and remain. The Buddha is saying very clearly just what you rushed into saying, which was very true. The way to overcoming these five hindrances is only through the jhanas. If you get a jhana, even the first jhana, only then, according to this, the five hindrances plus discontent and weariness not invade the mind and remain. Otherwise, even if it's just something less, the five hindrances invade the mind and remain. Yeah. Aha. Okay. You have to suppress the hindrances as best you can to get the jhanas. In the path into jhanas, the hindrances are overcome. But before you get into the jhanas, the hindrances are still either there or they are latent, can come up at any time. But they haven't been really dealt with. So yes, to enter the jhana, the hindrances have to be got past. But they haven't really been defeated. So it's as if you're sneaking past them to get into jhanas. But after jhanas, you kick their ass. They're down and out for a long time. This very separate from the taints. The taints are called the asavas. It's similar. The word taints in here is asavas. And the literal meaning of that is like outflowings. So again, it's a word which you have to understand. What the heck does that mean? But when you understand that when, say, you're meditating, it's very hard for the mind actually to go inwards, even actually to stay on the breath. It always goes out onto other things. There's a sound of somebody talking, the mind goes out to the sound. It goes out to the past and the future with your memories, or even little expectations of what should I do next, which is an outflowing of the mind. It's a desire, oh, I want to get jhanas. It's a mind going out from where it is to somewhere else. So you can see that stream of the mind, the inclination not to stay home, but always to go out. And home, I mean a real inner home deep inside of yourself. And it's, so because we can't stay put, why? Because it's an outflowing. And this is actually what that word means. Of course, that those outflowings, they can manifest as these hindrances. The first one, central sensory desire. Well, this thing they call covetousness is all the mind going out, looking for something else, what we want. Ill will is actually driving us from where we are. It's not the somewhere else pulling us, it's where we are pushing us away. And restlessness and remorse, as you know, will always drive you out. And restlessness all over the place, remorse, you don't feel happy, so you just want to escape somewhere else. And it's also sloth and torpor. It doesn't actually drive you out. So it's in one sense, that's not really an asava, it's a result of asavas. That's why of all those five hindrances, that's the one I say is the least dangerous. But that is just, you know, you're just a bit dull, you can't see what's going on. And the doubt, again, is just, it's one of the reasons why one is restless. Was what is this? Thinking backwards and forwards, never really staying still enough to see what's really there. But it's interesting here that the Buddha adds two extra ones, like weariness. For those of you who've been on a retreat, let alone a retreat, who live life, oh my goodness, life is so tiring sometimes. Do you ever feel like weary? Sometimes just weary in your body, or weary of, you know, having the same old food, or wearying of having the same old wife, weary of having the same old husband, weary of doing the same things. And that weariness, you can see, is like a negativity. It's also a physical tightness, but a negativity to life itself. And the answer to what that weariness is, it is a lack of mental energy. And this is the insights which can come to you in deep meditation. The more still you are, especially if you do get to that happiness and joy which is apart from sensory pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, that's a very still happiness. And the reason it's very strong, because it's born of the stillness of the mind. It energizes the mind, and that's why the mind is not weary anymore. Bubbly, light, and very engaging. So that's the weariness. And it's also, the discontent is another angle on the weariness. Sometimes you've ever just been so discontent. You look in the fridge, there's nothing to eat. You look on the TV, there's nothing to see. All the programs are just so terrible these days. You know, you look even on your CDs of Ajahn Brahm or Sister Wayam. I've heard them all before. Just everything's just so boring. That discontent, it's nothing to do with what's outside. It's all to do with the fact that the mind has got no energy, especially no positive energy. When you get to these jhanas, you get so much energy, so much bliss. There's no such thing as weariness. There's no such thing as discontent. It vanishes from the mind through those times. So you don't become a complainer, a fault finder. Not good enough. I'm just so tired. So weary. Life is so tough. Being spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of West Australia. I'm retiring. I'm putting in my resignation. No, don't do things like that, because you're bright and happy, because that comes from the power of the mind. So the five hindrances plus discontent and weariness have vanished when you get into jhanas. You know, sometimes when people go to these meditation retreats and they get into deep meditations, sometimes it's not uncommon they get into a deep meditation, they can't sleep that night, maybe for two or three nights. It's not that they're insomniacs, it's just they've got too much energy to sleep. They just sit there, not worrying, just too bright, too alert. It's not uncommon. If that ever happens to you, don't worry about it. You're not going crazy or mad. After two or three days, it all wears out and you go back to sleep as normal. But enjoy it while you've got it. That time you don't need to sleep. Too much energy. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the weariness is, again, same antidote, just be very, very still and you get more energy coming up. But one of the big insights, I wish more people would say this, that the energy of the mind is happiness. It's another form of happiness which people don't realize. You know, the dullness of the mind, especially, you know, through alcohol or drugs or just through sort of the blind, aimless watching Big Brother or any other stupid reality shows, laugh or laugh, you know, that's, you get sort of, there's no energy involved in there. No wonder you get depressed. Maybe that's one of the causes of, you know, lots of depression, that too many reality TV shows these days. I think you can probably get quite a good correlation there. But whatever it is, that, you know, that sort of thing sort of does not give you an uplift, does not give you energy of the mind. When the mind becomes energized, it also comes along with happiness. The mind becomes energized, and then really energized with bliss, and then just the mind becomes very easy to become still. Whatever it sees engages it. And you know, you can become content with many things. which normally you get aversion towards. That's what I was just saying as a joke. I forget why I said it. Just now, even if you, now after a jhana, you can see some dog shit in front of you and say, wow, that's amazing, just how beautiful that is. The different sort of shades of brown in there. And such a rich smell. My goodness. But actually, that's what would happen. Because the mind is so bright, everything looks beautiful. Even dog poo. So if you ever see somebody sort of, you know, at this center here, kneeling down in front of a dog poo, and say, wow, look at that. Don't think they're crazy. Don't send them to grey lands. They probably just come out of a deep meditation. Monks are weird. Anyway, just a joy there. But the main point of that paragraph is to say that the five hindrances, especially, plus these extra two of weariness and discontent, those five only do not invade the mind and remain after first jhana or something more deep. That's nala kalpana. So having said that, the Buddha went a bit further. That's the main part of the sutta. How then, Anuruddha, do you all think of me in this way? The Tathagata, our teacher, that's the Buddha, has not abandoned the taints that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. That is why the Tathagata uses one thing after reflecting, endures another thing after reflecting, avoids another thing after reflecting, removes another thing after reflecting. Now, first of all, I should have said the previous paragraph there, all about delighting, because this is a delight which you're supposed to get in monastic life, the delight and pleasure of those jhanas which abandons the hindrances. So that's why the monks are happy and delighting in their life, because they're getting these jhanas. But now he's actually saying that the Buddha is actually hasn't really become enlightened. He's still got the asavas, the defilements, like sensory desire and ill will, which actually make the mind move out into things. That's why the Buddha eats food, he uses these robes, he does this and does that. Is it because that, you know, he's not really enlightened, but he has craving? And the monks reply, no, Venerable Sir, we do not think of the Blessed One in that way. We think of the Blessed One in this way. The Tathagata has abandoned the taints that defile, these are the outflowings of the mind, that bring renewal of being, or other words, reincarnation, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. That is why the Tathagata uses one thing after reflecting, endures another thing after reflecting, avoids another thing after reflecting, and removes another thing after reflecting. So he does this not out of outflowings, out of cravings, out of attachments, but after reflecting. What do you think the Buddha reflects on then? After reflecting on what? Why would the Buddha use something, or endure something, or avoid or remove something after reflecting? What would he reflect on? Anyone got any suggestions? Yeah, three characteristics. It's not me, not mine, not a self, just impermanent, just suffering. So he has to use these things. So when you're eating your food, he reflects it's impermanent. It doesn't last long, especially the way I eat. It's suffering, because if it's very delicious food, it's gone in a second. You can't linger. If it's not very nice food, you have to eat it, especially as a monk. So eating is a lot of suffering. Especially afterwards, you feel full, or you have to go to the toilet. But anyway, and it's also nothing to do with you. So why does the Buddha do anything? What's the purpose of a Buddha's life? Sharing, that's almost there. Sorry? Teaching, that's almost there. There's one very famous sutta there where the Buddha, just after his enlightenment, he's been followed around by this character called Mara. And the Mara was the control freaking chief, I call him. this leader in this heaven of those who exert power over other people's creations. And he was always trying to catch the Buddha out to prove that he wasn't enlightened. And one day he saw the Buddha in the hot season, just after lunch, going back to a quiet place and crashing out in the middle of the day. He caught him taking a snooze. And the Maharaj said, "I've caught you. You're not a real Buddha. You're not a real Arahat. What are you indulging for, having a snooze in the middle of the day when other people are working? Even the people who feed you, they can't afford to rest in the middle of the day. You're just a lazy imposter. Why are you laying down in the middle of the day?" And the Buddha gave this very beautiful answer. "I'm taking a rest in the middle of the day for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings." That's a beautiful answer. Not for himself, for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. By resting, he could serve more, he could teach more. That's what motivates the Buddha. The happiness and well-being of all sentient beings. So that's why he would either use something, enjoy it, avoid it, or remove something for the sake of the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. So he'd use food and a robe or huts to look after his body so he could make use of that vehicle to teach, to inspire for the benefit of all beings. He would maybe endure, you know, people's abuse, having to teach for long periods of time, maybe just walking long distances. You know, even like as a monk these days, as a teaching monk, one of the things which you have to have, as well as loving kindness and wisdom, one of the requirements for a teacher in today's world is to have a very, very strong bladder. Sometimes I have to endure hours when I just die to go to the toilet. But you give a talk for a couple of hours and then people are lining up to actually to talk with you or answer their questions. And all you want to do is to get to the toilet quickly. Fortunately that I have a lot of endurance in that part of my body. And so that's another thing which you endure after reflecting. For the benefit of all sentient beings. And you avoid another thing after reflecting. In other words, you don't go looking for pain. You don't go sort of treading on snakes. You avoid them. And you know that, so that's going to make you ill and you won't be able to serve and help other beings. And removing another thing after reflecting, if something's in the way, or even as like a monk or a senior nun, if there's somebody misbehaving, you ask them to leave, to remove things. But after reflecting, not because you hate a person, but for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. As I was taught by my monks, if you're in any position of authority, your compassion has to go not just for an individual, but for the whole group. So there were sometimes I would allow some visitor to come. I remember one visitor in particular, and she was just a battle axe, always angry, would swear at the monks and say she's coming with an M16 to shoot them all. And I saw her soft side. I had a lot of compassion towards her and let her stay in the monastery. And the monks took me aside and said, "Ajahn Brahm, you're very, very compassionate by allowing this terrible woman to stay in this monastery. You're very compassionate to her, but you're not at all compassionate to us. You know, we have to also live with this girl. So please don't let her come again." So I had to say to her, "You can't come again." Because my compassion had to go not just to one person, but to other people as well. And so I removed from our monastery somebody after reflecting on the meaning of compassion. Sometimes you have to do that. If you're kind to one person, you're very, very unkind to many others. So your compassion has to be with wisdom and has to be even. Any comments about that? Don't worry, I'm not going to remove any of you. You're all fine. Good, good, Anuruddha. This is top of page 568, the fourth line. Good, good, Anuruddha. The Tathagata has abandoned the taints that defile the asuras, which bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. He has cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump. If you cut the top of a palm tree, it doesn't grow anymore, it's dead. So sometimes, you know, you have to cut things at the root or at the base. But a palm tree, if you cut it at the top, it also kills it. So it's like a palm stump. In other words, it can't grow again. These asuras, done away with them, so they are no longer subject to future rising. Just as a palm tree whose crown is cut off is incapable of further growth, so too the Tathagatas abandoned the taints that defile, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Okay, so some interesting points there. First of all, so once the Buddha becomes enlightened, can he become unenlightened? Can he revert back to being an ordinary person again? Shall we take a vote on it? The point here, he says, absolutely no. It's, these things are cut off at the root like a palm tree stump. In other words, they're dead. They cannot grow again. They're completely done away with. And also, can a Buddha get reborn again? And here it says, abandon the taints that defile. If they abandon those things that bring renewal of being, which give rise to future birth. These are all cut off like a palm tree stump. They don't grow again. They're dead, finished forever. Paragraph 8. What do you think, Anuruddha? What purpose does a Tathagata see that when a disciple has died, he declares his reappearance thus? So-and-so has reappeared in such-and-such a place. So-and-so has reappeared in such-and-such a place. Because when people died, they would go to the Buddha and say, now my uncle, you know, he gave food to you for many, many years. Now where's he been reborn? Is he reborn as a cockroach? Or has he been reborn as a heavenly being or human realm again? Where's he been reborn? And people wanted to know this. Even these days, when somebody dies, they always want to know, does he get reborn in heaven? Please, please, Ajahn Brahm, tell me he's been reborn in heaven. Because it makes you feel good if we say things like that. But now, it's not just to make people feel good, because you have to be honest. And I remember this one time when I think it was one of the kings. Was it Malika? I think it was Malika. The Queen Malika had died. And the king asked her, where has she been reborn? And he said, just, no, don't ask me that, great king. Come on, you know, you're a friend of mine, because King Prasenadi and the Buddha were very, very close. Now, come on, you can tell me. He said, look, I'll tell you in 3 days' time. Okay? I promise, I'll tell you in 3 days' time. So the king, all right, fair enough. He came back in 3 days. Said, where's my queen been reborn? Oh, she'd been reborn in the heaven realm. Ah, wonderful. And she was such a good girl. But you don't mind me asking, why did you not tell me straight away, if you knew? And the Buddha said, look, it was like this. As soon as she died, she had a bad thought, and so she did get reborn. When you asked me, she was a dung beetle in a pile of shit. And I didn't want to tell you that at the time, because you'd be disappointed, you wouldn't have understood. But now that was only just an anomaly of her karma, just a passing bad thought. Now that's all over with, now she's got reborn in the heaven realm. So that's why I stopped, I did not tell you straight away, otherwise you might not have understood. It's the same then if maybe your mother died and you asked me and I said she'd just been reborn as a dung beetle, you would not be very happy with me. But if I told you afterwards, well, she's only there for 3 days, now she's in heaven. Oh, it doesn't really matter, that's fine. So the Buddha was actually very sensitive. But why does the Buddha say when someone has died that they have reappeared in such and such a realm? And here the monks said, basically, we don't know. But they never actually said, we don't know. They always said it in this way. Venerable sirs, our teachings are rooted in the Blessed One, guided by the Blessed One, have the Blessed One as their resort. It would be good if the Blessed One would explain the meaning of these words. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the monks will remember it. It's a much more refined way of saying, I haven't got a clue. But that's really what it meant. Anuruddha, It is not for the purpose of scheming to deceive people, or for the purpose of flattering people, or for the purpose of gain, honor, or renown, or with the thought, let people know me thus, that when a disciple has died, the Tathagata declares his reappearance thus. So-and-so has reappeared in such-and-such a place, so-and-so has reappeared in such-and-such a place. Rather, it is because there are faithful clansmen, inspired and gladdened by what is lofty, who, when they hear that, direct their minds to such a state, and that leads them to the welfare and happiness for a long time. So when the Buddha was actually saying these things, it was not just out of his ego so people would give him more fame. It certainly was not actually to get sort of more donations for his monastery or more goods. That was never in the Buddha's mind. But that's how some people would act. Sometimes they're fortune tellers. And sometimes people can go to these fortune tellers or mediums after they die and, please tell me where my father has been reborn, or my child has been reborn. And sometimes they do that just to get gains or whatever. There was a scam which is apparently still going on in Malaysia in particular, that when a person dies or is dying, the monks sit around that person and do some chanting, and they always, every now and again during the dying process, feel the temperature of the person's head and their feet to see which one is warm at the very end. Because they have the idea, and this actually came from a middle age, or sort of about a text, a Buddhist text in about, I think, the 8th or 9th century of the Common Era, where someone went along and said, this is not from original Buddhist teachings, they said, if the feet are the last part of the body which is warm, that means the soul goes out through the feet, and that's a sign of going to the lower realms. But if the head is the last part which is warm, and the feet are cold, but the head is slightly warm just before death, that means the soul will go out through the head, and that's a sign they're going to get reborn in the heavenly realms. And that's actually written in one of these ancient books. So what the monks do, they go around when someone is dying, chant, 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 and they feel the temperature. And other people feel the temperature. See? The head is warm, the feet are cold. Because of our chanting, we've got your scallywag husband, you know, who had a mistress. You know that, we know that, now he's gone to heaven. And the family are just so impressed. They give this huge donation to the monks. Because it would do. I mean, you know, you love your husband. Even though you had a mistress, you want him to go to heaven. And there you are, you've got proof of it. But the point is, as any medical student would know, the last part of the body which collects all of the blood or any energy is the brain, the most sensitive, important part of the human body. And so it's by nature, it will always happen that the lower extremities of the body will be starved of blood much, much before the blood starts flowing into the brain. So it always happens that the brain gets warm last of all. So according to medicine, everyone goes to heaven. But obviously that's a lot of ridiculous stuff. But sometimes the people do this. And why do they do this? Because there's a lot of dollars to be made out of this. Or rather sort of a lot of ringgit in Malaysia. And that's not what the Buddha does, you see. Nor to flatter people. Oh, you know, because it's nice if you've got lots of rich disciples to say, oh, you know, yes, your father went to heaven. And then they keep coming back to your temple. If you said, no, he was really a scatterwack. You know he didn't keep the five precepts. He's burning in hell right now. He's been born as a dog. And then they'll probably go to another temple which will be willing to flatter them. But not the Buddha here. We're not really concerned about gains and honour or renown, or with the thought that may people know me thus. The Buddha says these things because they are faithful clansmen, inspired and gladdened by what is lofty. And especially if you tell a person is being reborn into a beautiful state, because that will inspire them. And if they have been a good person, they've done good deeds, and you can tell, yeah, you see, because of their kindness, because they were always giving donations, keeping precepts, being forgiving, being soft with their voice, always caring, helping out. See, yeah, they've been reborn in heaven realms. See, it works, and that can inspire people. So the Buddha would say that sometimes. And so the Buddha expands now. I'll pause for a moment. Is there any questions or comments on that so far? Okay. Paragraph 10. Here, a bhikkhu hears thus. The bhikkhu named so-and-so has died. This is a monk. And the Blessed One has declared of him, he was established in final knowledge. That's another way of saying it, fully enlightened. And he has either seen that Venerable One for himself or heard it said of him. That Venerable One's virtue, that's his precepts, was thus. His state of concentration was thus. His wisdom was thus. His abiding in attainments, such as jhanas or psychic powers, was thus. His deliverance was thus. So if you know somebody like that, you recollecting that monk's faith, virtue, learning, generosity and wisdom, he also directs his mind to emulate such a state. And in that way, a monk has a comfortable abiding. You're inspired by monks or nuns who've really made it in this world. But usually we, as said here, I make this point only after the person has died. So that's usually when they're alive. A lot of monks just keep very, very quiet about their teacher's attainments. Maybe after they died, then you can say that Ajahn Chah was this or was that. But not when they're alive. Here a monk hears thus. The bhikkhu named so-and-so has died. The Blessed One has declared of him, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, he has reappeared spontaneously in the pure abodes, and there will attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. And he has either seen that Venerable One for himself, or he has heard it said of him, that Venerable One was thus in virtue, concentration, wisdom, attainments, and deliverance. And so recollecting his faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom, he directs his mind to the same state. In that way, the monk has a comfortable abiding. So you just get inspired. And what is a person? What do we call a person who's abandoned the five lower fetters? What do we call such a person? A non-returner, yeah. The non-returner. And they appear spontaneously in the pure abodes. What does that mean, spontaneously? What it really means is that when you get into a pure abode, or any deva realm, you're not like born in an egg or born as a baby. You're fully formed as a deva, fully mature. So there's no sort of growing up. You know, you appear just fully formed, fully adult, if you like, in the deva realms. And you don't age at all in the deva realms. You're just like that as you appear in there for many, 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 many long years. And the death actually is, you don't really die, just the thing fades away very quickly. Because it's only a mind made body, not a physical body. So there's no maturity and there's no aging. It's just you arise and you pass away. That's why in the deva realms you don't need to go to school. No more nappies in the deva realms. You don't need to wear a dummy. Nappies, yeah. Yeah, but it's similarly, but the deva realm is more real and more complex. But this is in the Sudarasa, in the pure abodes. There you appear, and you're already fully formed, and there to last a long time. You never come back from there. You always, from there, you go off into Nibbana. Which is why there was Venerable Kesari Dhammananda once suggested this may have actually been the source of the idea of the pure lands. Because in Mahayana Buddhism, the pure land is supposed to be a place where you go and you never come back from there. That's your last life. And these are called pure abodes. Pure land, pure abodes. You can see there's some similarity there. Both in the name and the fact that once there, you never come back to this land. You become enlightened right there. Only in the Theravada and these early teachings of the Buddha is obviously that to do this, that just reciting a name of Amitabha is not enough. You have to abandon the five lower fetters. And the next question now, what are those five lower fetters? What's the first fetter? Who knows what that is? Begins with an E. Sorry? No, that's number three. Rites and rituals is number three. That's not just rites and rituals, it's the belief that rites and rituals by themselves are a way to enlightenment. Sorry? Sensory pleasure, no, that's number four. That's karma raga, the lust for the five senses. Non-self, yeah, that's number one. Sakaya ditti, which is the view that there's a self in here somewhere. What's number two? Actually, I got that wrong. The Sakaya ditti is number one. The attachment to rites and rituals is number two. Sorry? Culture.
In other words, we define ourselves by our social cultural
norms. Not really. It's actually the word is sila bhatta. No, sila is exactly the same word for precepts. And bhatta is like vata is like your duties. So these things are good in themselves. It's good to keep precepts. It's good to do your duties, to keep the duties in your profession. You know, as a husband, your duties to your parents, those are all duties. But the point was that there's nothing wrong with those duties or the keeping precepts. It was that not taking them any further, thinking that that's enough. That was the hindrance there. And the other one was vichikicca, was skeptical doubt. Those are the first three hindrances. The fourth, not the hindrances, the first three of these fetters, lower fetters. The fourth one is the desire for sensory pleasures in the realm of the five senses. And the last one, vayapada, ill will. Those are the five fetters which the anagami, the non-returner, abandons. The main two of those is the self-view, which allows one to let go. If there's no self in here, you can disown things. It doesn't belong to me, anyway. And the fourth one is the desire or the attachment to the five sense world. And once those attachments to the five sense world has been overcome, then of course you get into jhanas. So as people get into jhanas a lot, they're the ones who should become anagamis. Non-returners. Now, paragraph 12. Here, among, here's us. The bhikkhu named so-and-so has died. The Blessed One has declared of him, with the destruction of the three fetters and with the attenuation of lust, hate, and delusion, they have become a once-returner, returning only once to this world to make an end of suffering. And he has either seen that Venerable One for himself, or he's heard of him, he was such and such a monk, and gets inspiration, tries to emulate them, and they have a comfortable abiding. In other words, they get the same state. So the once returner, it's very hard to define that accurately. All they say is they've attenuated lust, hate and delusion, but they don't say how much. And in one of the suttas in the Sangyutta, there was these two, I think they were brothers, Purana and Isidatta. I think Isidatta had a wife, Purana was celibate. And when they died, people asked them, well, how did they go? And they said they were both once returners. How can that be? Once was have a wife, was sleeping with her all the time, and the other one was celibate. And he said, well, look, it's true that Isidatta had a wife. You know, he was indulging in the sense pleasure, but he was just really sharp with his wisdom. So he made it to being a once returner. The other guy, Purana, he was celibate, but he was a bit slow. So his precepts were very strong, but his wisdom wasn't all that sharp. But he still made it to being a once returner. So it's so hard to actually to make that assessment of being a once returner or not. Greed, yeah. That's very good. Is greed and hatred also weakened because of stream winner? Yes, it is weakened through stream winner. It has to be weakened on the part of being a stream winner. So it doesn't actually say how much you have to weaken it to become a once returner. But the reason why, and it's, I've been talking about this a lot, the reason why a stream winner can't, will not go down to those lower realms, because of their understanding of non-self, they realize this, they do not own their deeds. They can let go of the past. Basically, they can forgive themselves. So an Angulimala actually became an arahat, but if, even if he didn't become an arahat, just was a stream winner, he could forgive all those past murders he did. He could let them go. He wouldn't have the conscience simply because he let go of the self, which creates a conscience. It's a very fascinating point. Why can't people forgive themselves? Why do people feel guilty? Why you can go to a therapist or a monk and say, you made a mistake, move on. But you can't, because of your sense of self. Ego is not such a, is not only the harbour of praise and thinking wonderful things about yourself. Ego is usually the place where guilt and lack of self-esteem live also. Yeah. Okay. The less ego you have, the less depressed you are. And certainly the less guilty you feel. Okay, that's answered by saying, turning the question backwards, a person who, actually this is for the tape, you're asking, that's just like saying a person can just break all the precepts and think, oh, it's not me doing those things, it doesn't really matter, I don't need to care. The point is that if a person understood non-self, then there is no reason to break those five precepts. Because the breaking of those five precepts is only because of like greed, hate and delusion, which is coming from the delusion of a sense of self. Why do you have greed? It's only because there's someone in here who wants something, who wants to control things and own things. As Buddha said, that once there's a self, then there's things which belong to me. If there's no self in here, you don't own anything. So greed and ill will just disappear. There's no way you can break precepts. So that's why is you don't need to make a big concern about that. If a person could forgive themselves and could let go of guilt, there is no means by which they can break precepts. Have you ever noticed people who are guilty recommit the same crime again and again and again? Guilt that you know doesn't stop the repeating the deed. Very self-absorbed with grief. You're also just very depressed, feeling you're not worth anything. And when you don't worth anything, you just don't try anymore. There's no energy for improvement. So when you let go of your past, you usually become a better person. Okay, but great question. Thank you for that. And 13. Here a monk hears thus. The bhikkhu, this goes for lay people. It goes, bhikkhu is coming next. Here a bhikkhu hears thus. A bhikkhu named so-and-so has died. The Blessed One has declared of him, with the destruction of the three fetters, they have become a stream enterer, no longer subject to perdition. That's the lower realms of the hell realms, the ghost realms, the animal realms. Why? Because you go to those realms because you want to punish yourself. Because you think you've done a bad thing. You have done a bad thing, but you just can't forgive yourself because you've got too strong a sense of self. With the three fetters have become a stream winner, no longer subject to the lower realms. They are bound for Nibbana, headed for enlightenment. And he's either seen such a venerable one, or he's heard him speak, or heard of him, and that inspires him, and he aspires to be the same. In this way, too, the monk has a comfortable abiding. Now, do the same with the bhikkhunis. Here, a bhikkhuni hears thus. This bhikkhuni, named so-and-so, has died. the Blessed One has declared of her, she was established in final knowledge, in other words, the Arahat. And she has either seen that sister for herself or heard it said of her. That sister's virtue was thus, her meditation was thus, her wisdom was thus, her abiding attainments was thus, her deliverance was thus, and recollecting her faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom, she directs her mind to such a state. In this way, the bhikkhuni has a comfortable abiding. Here a bhikkhuni hears thus, a bhikkhuni named so-and-so has died, the Blessed One has declared of her, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, she has reappeared spontaneously in the pure abodes, a non-returner, and will there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. He has declared of her, with the destruction of the three fetters and with the attenuation of lust, hate, and delusion, she has become a once returning once to this world to make an end of suffering. Or 17, he has declared of her, with the destruction of the three fetters, she has become a stream winner, no longer subject to perdition, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment. And she has either seen that sister of herself or heard of her, and so she directs her mind to such a state. And that way too, the bhikkhuni has a comfortable abiding. So the Buddha was declaring the monks, this is what they got up to after they died, they were this state or that state, or the nuns were. But remember, after they died, don't say anything about them while they're still alive. You all know that story that because people thought Ajahn Chah was fully enlightened, and if you give alms to someone who's fully enlightened, or even the stream winner, you get more merit, you get more bang for your bucks, as they say. So because of that, that anyone in their right mind, it's obvious, you try and find an arahat to give alms to. Because, you know, you've only got a certain amount of money and you've got to look after your own future. So why invest in a sort of, you know, in a market where there's not going to be many returns? When in the next monastery you've got this arahat living there and a little bit of food and you get huge amounts back afterwards. Which is why the food in the monastery in Thailand 32 years ago now was absolutely disgusting. There's sometimes boiled rice and one frog. Sometimes it's the curries were made out of ants' eggs or snails, and the snails were like eating these erasers you use to, you know, on pieces of paper. They just could hardly chew them. And there's this other really disgusting food we used to eat in those days. And there's no exaggeration, it was disgusting. But every now and again, somebody would come from town. On one occasion, this truck pulled in with all these pots on the back. And I thought, hey, at last, today I'm going to eat a nice meal instead of, you know, frogs and ants' eggs and, you know, rotten stuff. And the guy came out. His whole back of the ute was full of pots and pans. And we knew he came from town, so there'd be some really nice curries and stuff. And he came out and said, is Ajahn Chah here today? No, they'd gone to a house for lunch. So he got in his car and drove away. Because there was no merit to be made for feeding monks like me. You wanted to feed someone like Ajahn Chah. Now that's the reason why we don't say who's doing what. So be careful. You don't know which monk or which nun. So that's why, because we don't tell. To make sure that you cover all bases, you have to give food to Bodhinyana, food to Dharmasara, food everywhere, and that way everyone gets fit.
And may I just sidetrack a little bit? What is the exact meaning of liberated both ways for an arahat?
Liberated both ways for an arahat, it's actually described very clearly in the Anguttara Nikaya. Liberated one way means you've only attained your liberation with the up to the fourth jhana. If you have arupa attainments as well, the immaterial attainments, that's the both ways. That's the only difference there. Nothing to do with psychic powers, nothing to do with remembering your past lives. It's just whether you've got to that attainment with the arupa states or without them. Very clear in Anguttara. You've got to be careful though that sometimes in the Pali Text Society edition, they've done so much abbreviation, because when you read the Pali, sometimes it just repeats it again and again and again and again and again. Sometimes even the monks who wrote these things down years ago just were getting very careless at the end of a long day of translating or transcribing. They just use this word payala, which means etc. And they weren't careful there, but there are Because this goes at the very end of the Anguttara Nikaya, which is the last major section of suttas, and if you look very carefully at some of the Thai or some of the original in Thai or in Burmese, sometimes you can actually see the whole lot written out there. And in those ones, it's very clear that the both ways with arupa attainments, the one way or on only one side, is just with the jhana.
And Ajahn, where does Ajahn, where comes the expression of drei arahant or drei attainment? Is that the?
It comes from commentaries. It was never ever said by the Buddha, not once. There's no such thing. Basically, it was an invention which came afterwards, trying to make things easy for somebody, trying to have a shortcut when it wasn't any shortcut. No such thing as a person who gets enlightened without a jhana. There's lots of suttas in here which says so. You need a jhana, nothing less, for enlightenment. Any comments about that? If you don't agree with that, we're having a conference in a couple of weeks' time, and that's going to be one of the subjects. The Vipassana, Jhana, the Tibetan Mahamudra, or what was the other one? I think Satori Zen. Yeah. Are they the same? Is there any difference there? Can you have one without the other? And it should be, I heard from somebody, I saw them in Bangkok, that Patrick Kearney is gunning for me. He's a Vipassana guy, and I'm a Jhana guy. So we can have some fun. Showdown, high noon at the convention center. So it's going to be good fun, this. Is that okay? Okay. Yeah, at the back. Fairness, yeah, go on. Yeah.
Then 5 minutes has
dropped away. Yeah. Good question. So if you drop the fetter of non-self, in other words, you see very clear there's nobody in there, why don't all the other fetters fall away and all the hindrances fall away as well? It's because the nature of the mind, it works on... This is a straight Buddhist teaching. It's called the teaching of the Vipalasas. It works on three levels of cognition, on view, perception, and thought. And of those, the view is the more fundamental. You know, does a chicken come before the egg, or the egg comes before the chicken? Even though they're all sort of linked together, the view is the more fundamental. So because of your view, you perceive in a certain way. Even your bare perceptions, which come to your senses, they're not perfect, they're not raw. Even you've chosen subconsciously before you even see something or hear something. It's all been filtered according to your views. And those perceptions become the building blocks of your thoughts. And your thoughts justify your views. That's for a long time as a young monk, because I was a Buddhist, I couldn't understand how anybody in their right mind could be a Christian. You know, it's... How can you believe in a God or in this world which was created about 10,000 years ago? That's a problem for me, because people do believe in that. Why? And this Buddha's teaching on the three levels of cognition made it very clear. Once you start off with a view, you know, if you can put your mind in the mind of a Christian, you view that, yeah, there is a Jesus, there is a God, and God created this world, then that bends all your perceptions. You actually, only some perceptions are allowed to come to fruition in your consciousness. And everything bends accordingly. And so it's amazing, just the nature of the mind. Anything which challenges those views, you literally cannot see, you cannot hear. Only those things which justify that view are allowed actually into consciousness. And you think according to those perceptions. So the Christians are convinced. They think, yeah, it's obvious. Why can't everyone else be a Christian? and their thoughts justify their views. I'm talking about the evangelists, or even like the suicide bombers. How can they do that sometimes? And people look at these, not stupid people, they're intelligent people, they come from good families, they've got money. What do they want to do this for? Once you get a certain view, and that view is inculcated in madrasas by some fiery speakers, you get a person like that, you change their view, and they'll perceive the whole world accordingly. And they'll think that way, and they'll just keep reinforcing the views. So, you can understand how that works. That's why you can't trust what you think. Even your bare perceptions, you can't trust. Until the fetters and hindrances are completely abandoned. Only then does the whole process work without any bias. But when the hindrances are overcome, you see clearly the first part of that cycle, which is abandoned, is on the level of view. You've seen non-self. There's no one in there. The will is just a process. The knower is just a process. But that takes a while to filter into the other levels of cognition. So actually you perceive in terms of non-self, not me, not mine. You think in terms of not me, not mine, not a self. So the stream winner has perfect view. That, they've got it. But very often they perceive and think according to what the Buddha called habitual tendencies. The old habits of mind, thinking, perceiving in terms of a self. The best simile which I can give is like a person who is a smoker. They know that smoking is going to kill you. They know it very clearly, but they forget sometimes, and they have a drag. And it takes a while for that perception actually to work its way through until, I'm kidding myself, until they perceive it and they think it in every moment, then there's no way they can smoke. So that's why when you become a stream winner, 7 lifetimes at most, before you give up smoking. Smoking by greed, by hatred, and by all the other defilements. The mind doesn't smoke anymore. But it takes a while. And once returner, they've given up most things, but there's still a lingering habitual tendencies. So that's how it works. There's a time lag. Very, very well put. A lot of your sense of self is beyond the horizon. You just can't spotlight it. We don't know. We're deluded. That is why that you know that you've heard me speak so often, Chris. That's why jhanas are so important. It shocks you. You see this whole area which you just didn't see before. You didn't know was there. You go over the horizon. You see what's over there. You go outside of the prison you've lived in all your life. And see what's out beyond the walls of the 5 senses. The tadpole leaves the lake and sees what it's like on dry land. It's not that these things are inaccessible, it's just we don't go to the places where we can see clearly. So it's not so much a hidden teaching where no one can access, only like a few elite. Everyone can get there, just they don't bother. Touch you to make the journey.
There are well documented cases of that when an elder who attains stream entry and then who made the next jump onto Araharachi, running through the other 2 stages. Are there documented cases where a being would attain all 4 stages, like in one session, as it were, or in a very short sort of thing?
Are there documented cases where somebody attained all 4 stages of stream winning once returning, no returning, arahat in one go? You would probably say that most monks would answer yes, the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. But I think you've heard me say before that I reckon there's strong evidence the Buddha was a once returner. or rather Bodhisattva was the once returner when he was born into his last life. So that may be the case, but even Bahia, I think it's, whether it was Bahia was a stream winner or not, that's a tough one. I'd probably imagine he was. But no, it's very hard to document cases where people made all those four attainments in one go. Okay, where are we? We're on the bhikkhunis. We've got some more interesting stuff coming soon, and this is going to be controversial, but this is what it says. Here we go. Here a man lay follower hears thus. This man lay follower named so-and-so has died. The Blessed One has declared of him, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, he has reappeared spontaneously in the pure abodes and will there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. An anagami. He has declared of a lay follower with the destruction of the three fetters, the attenuation of lust, hate and delusion. He has become a once returner, returning once to this world to make an end of suffering. That's a once returner. Or he has declared of him with the destruction of the three fetters, he has become a stream enterer, no longer subject to perdition, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment. And he has either seen that, interesting here, there must be a mistake. No, they've got a venerable one. Is that a mistake in the, I have to check that one out, because talking about a layperson. That looks like it may be just Bhikkhu Bodhi probably made a little error of translation. Then we'll check that out later. For himself, or are they calling a lay Aryan a venerable? It's an interesting one. I'm going to check this out. I never noticed that before. That venerable one's virtue was thus, his state of concentration was thus, his wisdom was thus, his abiding attainments was thus, his deliverance was thus. Recollecting his faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom, he directs his mind to such a state. In that way, to a man lay follower has a comfortable abiding. So they're talking about the laymen. Now we're talking about the lay women followers. Here a woman lay follower hears thus. The woman lay follower named so-and-so has died. The Blessed One has declared of her with the destruction of the five lower fetters. She has reappeared spontaneously in the pure abodes and will there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. Or he has declared of another woman lay follower. With the destruction of the three fetters and the attenuation of lust, hatred, and delusion, she has become a once returner, returning only once to this world to make an end of suffering. Or he has declared of her, with the destruction of the three fetters, she has become a stream enterer, no longer subject to perdition, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment. And she has either seen that sister for herself, yes, sister is an honorific, for herself, or heard it said of her, that sister's virtue was thus. Her state of concentration was thus, her wisdom was thus, her abiding and attainments was thus, her deliverance was thus. Recollecting her faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom, she directs her mind to such a state. In that way, too, a woman lay follower has a comfortable abiding. So I never noticed this before. They're actually saying anyone who is an Arya, they call them either a venerable or a sister. They give them the same honorific as if they were an ordained monk. Fascinating. But who noticed something strange about the lay men followers and the lay women followers? You notice, I know you know. Who noticed something missing? Yeah. There was no mention of any enlightened, fully enlightened lay men followers or lay women followers. So there was equity with the genders, but there was no equity with the full enlightenment. Why do you think the Buddha left out enlightened lay men? Fully enlightened, I'm talking about, and fully enlightened lay women. Yeah, they may have to enter the Sangha to become. Oh, do they have to enter the Sangha to be enlightened? Sorry? Fully enlightened. Okay, the question is, can a lay person experience the attainment of full enlightenment?
They can, but they'll be a monk inside.
They're a monk inside. If they can, why has the Buddha not got them down here? Yeah, that's That's actually not said specifically by the Buddha. That's actually mentioned specifically in the text of Milinda Panha. That's where it's made most of. But it's implied. In other words, a layperson can attain full enlightenment, but once you become full enlightened, there's consequences to that. And the consequences, you have no more sensory desire, no desire to accumulate things, no desire for money, no desire for the things of the world. Basically, if you're a layperson, as they say these days, you're a square peg in a round hole. You just don't belong. And usually what happens, the only purpose for your life after becoming an arahat, fully enlightened, is to teach, to serve for other sentient beings. And if there is a sangha available, you will join. If there's nothing you can do, you give up the will to live and you just go to nibbana straight away. Yes. Pajeka Buddhas, they are arahats. It's a good question. That's a very good question. I think you stumped me this time. That's a great question. Pajeka Buddhas, they don't teach. Oh, yeah. I know the answer to that one now. The Pajeka Buddha, they can't teach, but they can still serve humanity by receiving their alms to be the field of merit. Well, that will keep them going. So even if you can't teach and serve with words, at least you can serve by who you are, being a field of merit, a peaceful, kind person. You have to be of use to other beings, because basically that, you know, yourself is completely gone now. There's no one left in here, so there's nothing to do anymore. That's why enlightenment, what's done has been done, there's no more to do. So the only reason why you continue is for the sake of other beings. Even like being a recipient of their alms to increase their good karma. That's the Pajeka Buddha. They would be in robes, the Pajeka Buddha, so join a sangha if there was one around. Otherwise, the tradition of alms would not be there for them. There'd be no purpose. Remember, to live, one of the most important things to continue existence is the will to live, the purpose, the meaning. If you really knew what enlightenment was, you'd understand in the layperson, there's no meaning anymore. You just die. The guy at the end got his hand up first, and then after. The fellow at the end first of all. And then, are you going to defer? Okay. Yes, sister? Do Pajeka Buddhas teach in higher realms? I think if a Pajeka Buddha could teach at all, they'd teach in the human realm. But whether they're taught in Deva realms or not. Remember, Devas are much harder to teach than human beings. The Devas are just having too good a time. It's much easier to teach people who live in Nolamara than people who live in Dalkeith. I think you understand what I mean. Yes, your question.
So the implication is that a layperson can't go straight to enlightenment?
Oh yeah, they can go straight to enlightenment. So a layperson can go straight to enlightenment and become fully enlightened. We talk, what happens next? That's the important thing. After becoming enlightened, you know, enlightenment is just not something you can just put on the side and put like on the your mantle shelf, like you've just, you know, won the bowling competition at sort of Nolamara bowling club. It's not just some little trophy you can just leave on there and allow to get dust. It's a complete change of the body and mind, and it has consequences. There's, you know, things like the nine things an arahat can't do. There are things they can't have sexual intercourse anymore. There's just no sexual forces in their body left. They can't get angry. They can't have fear. They just can't get afraid, even if someone's trying to kill them. Even an anagami, there's descriptions of like a lay person, a lady who became a non-returner in the time of the Buddha. And there's a wonderful description when she said that the king's soldiers came to arrest her son. They'd actually got the wrong guy, but they executed him in front of her for something he never did. And that was her son. And she said that her mind was even throughout. Not upset, no grief, no attachment, completely let go. Was at peace with the whole thing. Now that is what we're calling non-attachment. And that's an anagami, that's not quite the arahat. So you can understand just the mind of an arahat is very, very different than an ordinary person's. And that's actually how you can test out who's who. To see if they're afraid, see if they get upset, see if they get angry. If they get angry, they're not even an anagami, let alone an arahat. So there is consequences to that attainment. We understand what those consequences are. You can see they don't fit in the world. And they usually will go and join a monastery or a nunnery or somewhere. Yes, Lynn? Okay. Why are there such things as Pajaka Buddhas? Why can't enlightened one teach? Surely they can see the Dhamma, surely they can explain something to other people. They're not sort of dummies. The reason is that you can some of you had some deep meditations. Even after a deep meditation, you can't move. You're just so still and so cool. There's nothing to motivate you. After the full enlightenment experience, and that's magnified many times, there's nothing to make you move. There's no reason for teaching. All of your will, all of the past stuff, is like completely been eradicated. It ceased. And the only reason why Siddhartha Gautama taught was because somebody asked him. That was Brahma Sahampati. I told this story in Melbourne last week, and it came from one of my monks who's got a great sense of humour. Brahma means like God. Now the god Sahampati came down and asked the Buddha to teach. And if he hadn't have made that suggestion, Siddhartha Gautama would have been a Pajaka Buddha. So he said, thank God for Buddhism. And there's a truth in that saying. It is also saying that God was begging Buddha, please teach us. And without that, it's like without yeast, you can't get sort of bread. You just need that slight catalyst, the tiny thing, like this whole heap of snow on the mountainside. So it's all ready to go down, but all you need is someone to say, teach! And then the avalanche starts, and then we've got Buddhism, we've got the Dhamma. I think when it's not that sort of trigger, then a person's Pajaka Buddha. Yeah. Why is it considered to be because of maybe the purity and the power of his mind, completely pure, huge amounts of compassion, such a powerful loving kindness. So, and if you give him some food, just blast you with loving kindness. That will give you energy for a few lifetimes. They're powerful beings. Even if you get into a jhana, it's just incredibly powerful, let alone being a Pajaka Buddha and a Buddha. Wow. That's in a way, way, way up to the summits. So I think that would probably be one of the reasons why it's huge merit. But the best thing is don't just feed them. Please ask them, please, sir or madam, teach. Sure you can. You don't need anybody. But you've got to actually understand who that is, first of all. And actually, Brahma Sahampati, they say, it wasn't actually God, it was actually somebody from the Anagami, it was from the Sudawasa. Who recognized that was a Buddha and knew the rules of the game. So even though we're an anagrammy, come on, come and teach. Okay, we'll just finish off here because the kids are out and our car is being loaded up. So, Anuruddha, paragraph 24, it is not for the purpose of scheming or to deceive people. Scheming means like, I tell you, you help me. You know, if I tell you where your mother was reborn, you know, you give a donation to our retreat center, okay, deal? That's what scheming is, and grabbing one thing for another thing. Or for the purpose of flattering people, or for the purpose of gain, honor, and renown, or with the thought, let people know me thus. That when a disciple has died, the Tathagata declares his reappearance thus. So-and-so has reappeared in such and such a place. So-and-so has reappeared in such and such a place. Rather, it's because there are faithful clansmen inspired and gladdened by what is lofty when a person dies. The Ajahn Chah was an arahat. Or, you know, Ajahn Tate was this, or this monk, or this nun was that. And that's when we tell people, see, this is what happens at the end of their life. Not while they're still alive, but afterwards, to give you faith that, yeah, it's still possible in today's world. They did it, and you've seen them, you know them. Rather, it's because a faithful clansman is inspired and gladdened by what is lofty, who, when they hear that, direct their minds to such a state. And that leads to their welfare and happiness for a long time. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Anuruddha was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's word, together with all the others. That's the Nalakarpana Sutta. There's many parts to it. Just to sum it up, the part which I always quote, you need the jhanas to abandon the five hindrances. Without experience, at least the first jhana, the five hindrances invade the mind and remain, together with weariness and discontent. And also that the reason why the Buddha would say about who was enlightened and who wasn't was to inspire people, but only after that monk, nun, layman, laywoman had passed away, not before. And also what some of those states mean. So I hope you enjoyed that. So, very good. So now we can actually pay respects to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And remember, in 2 weeks' time, there will not be a Dhamma class, because we'll be all busy at the convention center. So the next Dhamma class will be in 4 weeks' time. The next Sutta class, 4 weeks? 4 weeks' time, not in 2 weeks, because we got busy with the conference. So that will free you all to be able to go to the conference.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavatā dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghaṃ namāmi.